Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Get ready, Ohio. FanDuel, America's number one sports book, is coming to the Buckeye State. And to kick things off, you can get started with $100 in free bets as an early sign-up bonus. Plus, when you sign up today with promo code OhioFD, you'll be all set when FanDuel goes live in Ohio. Then you can bet on all your favorite teams in all your favorite sports with $100 in free bets. Just download FanDuel's top-rated sportsbook app. It's safe, secure, and super easy to use. Ohio, this is your chance to get in on the action. Join today with promo code OhioFD. Make every moment more with FanDuel, official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 or older and present in Ohio. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable free bets that expire 7 days after FanDuel accepts its first real money sports wager in Ohio, 1-1-23. Unique user identity verification required. Offer ends on the go live date. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Lowe's, we're your go-to for great gardening values every day. That's why we've lowered our price on select bagged mulch, now starting at just $2.88 a bag. Mulch helps prevent weeds and retains moisture. And when you put it down around trees, shrubs, and flower beds, you'll see how beautiful it makes your outdoor space. Just in time to welcome back family and friends. Shop online and pick up in store. Lowe's, home to the best part of summer. Selection and product availability vary by location. While supplies last, U.S. only, excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Some cars are comfy on the inside, but don't have power on the outside. And some cars have the horsepower, but none of the comfort. I used to think there weren't any cars that were the total package. But that all changed when I got my Honda SUV. It's rugged and sophisticated. And right now, Honda has deals on the entire Honda SUV lineup. CR-V, HR-V, Pilot, Passport, you name it. So if you're looking for a car that's the total package, the only place you'll find it is at your local Honda dealer. Hurry before they're all gone.
It's still funny with Tim McCusick. This time it's the offense. I know there was some confusion on my posting. We'll get to that. This time we're breaking down the offense. Tim McCusick, how are you doing?
Life's good, Josh. How about you?
I'm doing better now because I think we're past all of our podcast hosting issues that we've been having the past few weeks.
That is good to hear. I don't think there's any podcast host that doesn't have some difficulties at some point. A relatively new medium. A lot of these things happen. We really appreciate our listeners for being patient with us and getting this fixed.
Right.
And I don't know where we'd be without Josh in terms of his ability to solve these sorts of problems.
So the podcasting, though it's been around for a long time, it's getting like more and more mainstream, which means there's more and more companies out there doing it. So we've been using one of the new companies, and they just aren't quite there yet. So now we're with the standard company that all the big names use. If it's a big podcast you've heard of, they're being hosted by this company that we're now with. So we're excited. It's going to bring stability. Anyone who, if you weren't getting your podcast in, if you were getting it in iTunes and the past couple episodes didn't show up, that should all be straightened out this week, or you should start to get them regularly again. If not, you can always just go in and hit unsubscribe, hit resubscribe, and that'll refresh everything for you as well. So it should make sure that the links on Russell Street Report work. The links on Birdland Sports is going to work for now on. And then as well as, of course, whatever podcast app you use, all those links will now work. It'll download immediately and all that stuff. We're in good shape right now.
Okay. Thanks, Josh.
So, but Speaking of, I don't know, now that we're straightened out, the Ravens are still figuring things out. So let's get to the Ravens, because we got on this a little bit with the defense as far as the Lamar Jackson situation. And we're going to get to that on this podcast. But first, let's look at, we got past the Bengals, which means we're still alive. So yeah. Let's look at these tiebreaker situations.
Yeah, so a lot of people have been asking me online on Twitter about what's the Ravens tiebreaker situation. So there's also a split camp on this, just like Jackson. There's a lot of people who don't want to hear anything about tiebreakers yet. They just say, well, let's see if we beat the Raiders first, or let's see if we beat the Chargers first, or let's see if we beat Atlanta first, kind of thing.
Well, you know, and that you're
true, even, just don't read.
And that you're even being nice to those people, because a lot of those people, it's not that they, let's see what happens. It's, I don't want the team to win because I want Harbaugh out of here.
Some of them have an agenda like that. Others, they don't really like tiebreaker talk because it kind of gets detailed and specific. And when you do that, sometimes it's difficult to understand. And so they are insulted even by the content.
All right. What I know is I went to ESPN and it told me that the Ravens have a 35% chance to make the playoffs. And it said that my fantasy team had a 25% chance of making the playoffs.
That's too bad for your fantasy team.
Right. So my fantasy team probably won't make it. The Ravens still have a little bit of control, so why don't you lay out what's going on there?
Sure. Well, they do have absolute control of their own destiny if they win out, obviously, from this point. Not obviously, but they do have control of their own destiny if they win out. But there are six tiebreakers that you have to go through. Okay, let's start at a higher level. The Ravens need to win the tiebreaker in the division, because that's what's determined first to determine which team, and it would be of either the Bengals or the Ravens, advances to participate in other tiebreakers with the remainder of the AFC.
Right.
So a necessary but not sufficient condition of making the playoffs is beating the Bengals in the tiebreaker, or beating them outright, one of the two. So when we say beating the tiebreaker, obviously we're only really concerned about what happens in the event of a tie. That's kind of a preset notion of this, is you both teams finish with the same record. Obviously, the Ravens could finish with a better record than Cincinnati, and that might be their easier path to the playoffs, by the way. But they also could finish tied, and that I think is still pretty darn likely. And if that happens, then we're going to need to go through a complex set of tiebreakers to find out who wins it. I just want to spend a couple minutes on that right now.
Yeah, because you're right. The Bengals, we could have a better outcome at the Bengals, but that would mean the Bengals would have to probably lose three games, and they don't have the hardest schedule left.
No, they don't. And they, you know, part of the what the Ravens have to hope for is for the Browns to beat the Bengals. And so we'll get to that with one of these steps here. Let's just start off with the head-to-head, because I think everybody understands that the head-to-head is the first thing you look at when you're breaking a tie between two teams.
And we already split.
Split that. Already decided it's a push. So we can move on to the second item, which is divisional record. So the Ravens currently have a 2-3 divisional record, and the Bengals are currently 1-2. The Ravens have only their Week 17 matchup against the Browns left. The Steelers have two games against the Browns, obviously home and road, and a Week 17 matchup with the Steelers. Now, here's where it could get kind of frustrating for Ravens fans. Either team can win the divisional record tiebreaker, but that's the best chance for Cincinnati to win a tiebreaker with the Ravens. And the reason is that they have a very favorable schedule layout going into this. The big thing is that their Week 17 game against the Steelers may be a rest game for the Steelers if they are locked in on seed. And I'll even put it a step further. The Steelers, if they are the locked-in 3 seed, could well control their own destiny with regard to which team they'd rather face in the playoffs. And I will guarantee you, 95% of Steelers fans would love to play the Bengals as opposed to the Ravens in the playoffs. So if it could well come down to Week 17, if the Steelers lose, they play the Bengals in the playoffs. If the Steelers win, they play the Ravens in the playoffs. So they could be disincented to help the Ravens in terms of what they are doing in Week 17, not just indifferent to helping the Ravens, where they might just want to rest their players and do it. But it's a very positive schedule situation to have a good team that you're playing, or top team you're playing, in Week 17, because that team may be laying down at that point for resting, and it's a really nice schedule advantage to have that. And the Bengals have it this year.
Yeah, that's
So we got to hope that the Steelers struggle a little bit so that, that they're fighting in that last game.
Yeah, they have to be playing for seeding, and ideally they should have to be – if they're playing for a bye in the last game. If they need that to get a bye, we can be guaranteed that they'll play hard.
Right, right. Because you would think they should be – in a standard play hard game, they should beat the Bengals.
They certainly would believe that's the case, and I agree. They certainly have owned the Bengals in recent years.
All right. So what's next? Common opponents?
Common opponents is next. Now, there's a shortcut to doing this, and people always look at common opponents and they get confused by it, and sometimes they give up on the process at this point. With divisional opponents, it's really simple. Look at the uncommon opponents. So there's only two games which the Ravens and Bengals do not have in common. The Ravens have beaten both Buffalo and Tennessee. The Bengals have beaten both the Colts and the Dolphins, who the Ravens won't play. Both teams are 2-0 against their uncommon opponents, which means against common opponents, they're going to have the same record. So that tiebreaker has already been decided. It's already a push. Don't strain yourself mentally to try and go through that. And when you have this show up in the future, it's the team with the worst record against non-common opponents that wins the common opponent tiebreaker. And that's the much easier way to do it. So anyway, for that one, no chance that decides the tiebreaker.
All right. Conference record then.
So a conference record is next, and a conference record is a big one for the interdivisional tiebreakers, where you're going against the other teams in the conference. But in division, it slips down behind the common opponent's tiebreaker. Very important there. The Ravens have an advantage in conference record, and they can win this tiebreaker, but they can't lose it. Now, why are we in that position? Again, the shortcut you do is you look at the NFC games and how those records have gone. And the team with the worst record against the NFC wins the conference record tiebreaker because all other games are in conference, of course. So the Ravens are currently 0-2 against the NFC with two games left against the Falcons and Bucks, and the Bengals have already finished their NFC schedule and are 2-2. So the worst the Ravens can do is tie this. It is possible they could lose to either the Falcons or the Bucks, still end up tied with the Bengals, and that would mean that the Ravens would win the tiebreaker here at conference record if this was consulted, if the Browns didn't win it by divisional record, or if either team didn't win it by divisional record. So conference record, the Ravens can win it. They can't lose it. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to imagine a meaningful divisional tie, meaning one where that both teams are at least 9-7, where the Ravens don't win both remaining NFC games. They're among their easier games. And in fact, the Atlanta game, I think most people would say, is really the pivotal game to making the playoffs this year. So while the Ravens have the advantage here, I don't think they can use it to win.
All right. All right. So then it would come down to strength of victory.
Strength of victory is next, and so that's a little bit of a weird one. That's the sum of the wins. It's also a percentage in one-loss ties, but it's the sum of the wins plus a half point for ties of all of the teams that you have beaten during the season. So if you look at it, the Ravens have currently an advantage on this. They have 19.5 wins. Now, each of the Bengals and the Ravens have each beaten each other, but the teams they have not beaten the teams they've beaten otherwise are the Ravens, Buffalo, who has 3 wins, Denver has 4 wins, Pittsburgh 7.5 wins, Tennessee with 5 wins for a total of 19.5. Cincinnati currently has 17.5 wins with wins over Indianapolis, Atlanta, Miami, and Tampa Bay. So a lot will still be determined down the stretch. The Ravens' big advantage clearly comes from the fact that they beat the Steelers earlier this year. The Ravens still have 2 big opportunities and also tough games. If they can beat either the Chiefs or the Chargers, that will do huge things for their strength of victory position. And similarly, the Bengals have the Chargers and the Steelers on the docket still. And if they can win either of those two, and as we mentioned, you know, with the potential laydown game in Week 17, that's their big chance to catch up in strength of victory. So definitely some difficulty for the Ravens to get in if strength of victory is consulted, and their big hope is to beat either the Chiefs or the Chargers down the stretch to secure that.
Right. Now, hopefully this is all worked out before all of this tiebreaker stuff, but the last step is strength of schedule, and I'm guessing that's still being worked out because games are still being played?
Games are still being played, and there's only two It's all driven by the two non-common opponents. Okay. So we go back to that, and the strength of schedule is exactly the same except for those two. And unfortunately, the Bengals have two playoff contenders who are the non-common opponents. That's Miami and Indianapolis. And the Ravens have the Bills and the – oh, come on now. Don't do this to me. Okay, the Bills and the – it's a South team, the Titans. So they only have one playoff contender among the two. And it's likely that the strength of schedule is going to work out in the favor of the Bengals if this continues. So if it drops the strength of schedule, which I think is about a 15% chance if tiebreakers are consulted, strength of victory I'd say is about a 60% chance, and the divisional record is about a the common opponents and divisional record, but both about the conference record or common opponents, both about a 70% chance of being consulted. You really have the likelihood that if it gets the strength of schedule, that it's going to be won by the Bengals.
Now, but all of this math that you've been doing is just for us head to head with the Bengals.
That's right.
There's other teams that are trying to fight for those wild card slots at all, like the Colts, who've gotten really hot. Mm-hmm. And even the Titans are in there. The Dolphins are in there. There's other teams fighting for that. Texans, yeah. Let's get focused again on the Ravens. We talked about Lamar Jackson a little bit on the previous episode, but let's get into him and let's grade him just like we do Joe Flacco. Let's look at Jackson's ample time and space. And I want to know how you really did this, because he moves quickly.
That's right. So there's a little bit more judgment that goes into it, but it's usually if he's able to stay in the pocket for 3 seconds, or if the offensive line allows him to do that, then he's got ample time and space. Jackson uncreated ample time and space a couple of times for himself, but that still goes as an ample time and space. One of them was when he hit Lewis in the back of the helmet with the ball.
Right.
That's his on him, but it was an ample time and space opportunity. Another was when he ran to the outside on a boot that was a naked boot, and then he ran directly at Carlos Dunlap, who was the unfooled outside defender. And it was an ample time and space opportunity, but it was something Jackson did, I think, to freeze Dunlap and create more time for him to make the decision on the throw. In any case, that counted as an ample time and space opportunity as well. The Ravens gave of their 21 dropbacks in the game, the Ravens gave Lamar ample time and space on 9 of 21, fairly normal number. If anything, a little low at 43%. Jackson had an inverted game, though. So he was 5 of 9 for 46 yards and threw his only pick when he had ample time and space. That's 5.2 yards per play. With ample time and space, he was 9 of 11 for 111 gross yards, and he also allowed 2 sacks for 12 on those, 99 net yards, 9.0 yards per play. Now, the typical is about 4.2 yards per play when you don't have ample time and space, or that's right. Been Flacco's typical over the years. So this is an exciting component about Jackson's effort that I don't think too many people are talking about, is how he performed under pressure. And there's a lot of definitions, of course, of pressure out there, but at least from an ample time and space perspective, I think that was one of the real positives to draw, is that he wasn't tremendously fazed by the pressure.
Does that mean, so, all right, that we keep talking about the two camps. So the pro Lamar camp would point this out as, look, our offensive line is all banged up. The advantage for the quarterback situation, Lamar's the better one with a struggling offensive line. Is that what ample time and space is showing you in these numbers, at least for the Bengals game?
The ample time space, it's just a slightly below average number, and certainly nothing I would rely on statistically to be accurate. I mean, I think the offensive line had a decent game of pass blocking, but 9 of 21 is 43%. That's slightly below average ATS percentage. Lamar did a great job when he didn't have ATS, and he did a pretty lousy job when he did have ample time and space. So when they gave him a good pocket, too, he really didn't use it very effectively.
Right. Gotcha.
So if you want both camps have some fodder to take away decide how they want to apply it.
Right. The not Lamar, I'm not going to call it an anti-Lamar, but a not yet Lamar camp would say, look, he doesn't know how to stay in the pocket.
Yeah, and let's address that for a second, because I hope those are the two camps, the not yet Lamar camp and the we love Lamar camp, you know, and we love everything about him. If those are the two camps, I'm kind of okay. If there's just somebody out there that has already decided that Lamar's not an NFL quarterback, that he's not going to last, I mean, get over it. At least root for the Ravens, you know, and root for Lamar to play well here.
You know, I very much see it as politics. That when you get online, everyone bickers and everyone tries to make it look like the other side is anti. When really, no one's anti. We just have different opinions of timing. And I think it really is a big not yet camp, which is also part of that not yet camp is a maybe Both never backup. Camp that, okay. that isn't quite ready. Nothing, not sure if Lamar can make the jump yet from college.
Right.
Would be what I would say.
All right. Well, there's also the pro Flacco group in there, which fairly enough, you know, points out that Joe Flacco has 21 TDs and 8 interceptions now in his last 14 or 15 yes. games. I mean, you've got a good alternative on the bench, which makes it all that more of a question in terms of how popular your backup quarterback is.
Right. Yeah. Right. There's definitely a pro Flacco, anti Flacco, thing out there, and I'm sure there's a race component too, but I don't really want to get into race and sports. No. I try to avoid that side and pretend that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I certainly hope there's not, but let's we're not gonna talk about it.
Right, we'll just move on. And I'm in the not yet camp, and what always concerns me watching him on Sunday was this sidearm throw and the way he was just some dangerous passes. How did it look when you watched on film?
Yeah, I mean, there are about 5 throws where he really threw dangerously. And I'll point out one where he made the throw, and it was one of the really big throws of the game. But if you look at it, it was a very high-risk throw. And I think you have to really kind of break it down a little more and decide whether or not it was a good one. But it was a throw to Mark Andrews that converted the 3rd and 7 for a 19-yard gain. He had thrown an interception previously with an underneath linebacker in exactly that spot. He actually threw the interception to the safety, but there was an underneath linebacker in that spot as well. On the other side of the field earlier in the game, he threw a tipped ball where the underneath linebacker leaped and tipped it. The throw to Andrews, the Ravens needed the completion to convert 3rd and 7, but if they got an incomplete, they still would have been in the ballgame at 21-21 and had a chance to go on and win the game. So a high-risk throw was not as warranted. Now, Jackson made an unbelievably elite throw on the play. He rolled right, threw the ball perfectly into a very tight window over the linebacker and right to the spot where Andrews went, and he did it on the run. And you put all that together, that's a very difficult combination of things. And I kind of liken it to praising a blackjack player for hitting 16 and getting a 5. It was the perfect result. But did he really necessarily make the right decision? Well, you'd have to look at underneath at what the count was at the time in terms of the remaining deck, and you know there are other factors that would go into blackjack in terms of deciding whether or not 16 is a correct is a hit or a stick. But in any case, it was a point where it didn't really you can't really ascribe all of that to Jackson other than he made a perfect throw. He did also reduce risk on the play in one significant way by allowing the corner to clear Andrews before he. Through the ball. So I really like that risk control element, but then the other risk control element, I kind of, you know, he'd already had some problems in the game with interceptable balls, and it was a great throw, I can say that, but it's kind of like maybe a 30-foot three-pointer that goes in that you say no, yes, when the ball goes in, that, you know, it just does not make it the right decision to throw that ball, but fantastic pass, great to see, incredible as a fan. And then you look at it on tape and you really wonder, was it great decision-making or not?
All right. Was it just me, or does he always run to the right? Like, at least his big runs were to the right.
We're talking runs from the runs, or are we talking about his where he rolls out?
Either one.
Okay. So let's start with the rollouts. I saw some. Jackson really appears to have the same problem as most right-handed quarterbacks do in rolling left. And you would think he would have less. The reason is that when he rolls left, he's got the speed to reset his feet and get over there. But he often leaves the pocket late, which means he's making an escape move to get away from a linebacker or an edge rusher who's got him, who appears to have him, and so, then that leads to a fairly close pursuit.
Gotcha. So, and then so, his body's all turned.
His body's turned, and he's got to reorient himself, which he has the same difficulty as really all right-handed passers do in terms of getting his feet reset and throwing the football. Now, we haven't seen that much of Jackson doing exactly that so far, but he had trouble throwing on the left side as I saw a scattered diagram of his passes, and you know, I'm thinking about which those were, and there definitely was some problems in terms of his ability to roll left. And it's normal for a right-handed quarterback. I just, at some point, I think it will be better for him, and he'll have the ability to reestablish pockets on the left side, given what his gifts are.
Right. The Bengals clearly were a good opponent for him to go up to. He was able to manage the clock the entire time and eventually get the win as well. We even got to see a little bit from him as far as a comeback drive.
Yeah.
So those were all good things. But how much do we have to keep in mind that it's the Bengals and be ready for this week that it's the Raiders, an even worse team that he'll be playing with?
I mean, I do think circumstances are pretty much ideal. It's, if you had to pick a time for Joe to be injured, you'd pick this. And you'd say, okay, maybe we can get through these two games, and maybe this is a good opportunity for Lamar to get some NFL reps. And it's certainly, in terms of a confidence builder, you know, facing this Bengals team, who is not—they're not as bad defensively as their historically bad run of 500-yard games has been. But they still are a great matchup for Lamar's particular skills and the combination of the two runners the Ravens presented. The Bengals really breaking down their four-man pass rush and their ability to do what they've done to Flacco over the years. So it's a great pair of games for him to get his feet wet and to give him the best possible chance to get off with two wins and the Ravens to stay in the playoff race because of it. So do I want to really project ahead to Atlanta in terms of what's going on, or even project ahead to this week? It's dangerous to do so, but I think it would be really great if Flacco could be ready to play in again in Atlanta, whether that's in a starting role or in a relief role if the team gets behind.
Right, and what's nice about this is that it's given Lamar more experience. It's given him on the field games with the linebackers, with the wide receivers, and it seems like I know he's still working on learning the play calling and all that, and that looked a little awkward at times during the game, but it seems like this team is behind him. It seems like he's a good leader on the field. Of course, it's way easier to project all that when you're winning the game.
Yeah, and that's true. It's going to be – some of the things will be more difficult when things are tougher. To give you an idea where Jackson's experience is probably hurting the Ravens. Now, a lot of people could have caught this. But the illegal formation penalty on 4th-and-1 is something Jackson could certainly be the one responsible for calling that timeout. Now, when I look at all the people who missed that, I don't blame Jackson entirely, but I would say that Peyton Manning probably catches that, and the Colts don't fall into the trap. In his prime. Tom Brady probably gets it also.
But forget about Tom Brady. Forget about Peyton Manning. There's Joe Flacco.
Quite possibly not, but Joe calls a lot of timeouts when things he sees are not right, so maybe.
Okay, so there's a precedence there that he has called timeouts for things lined up wrong.
For sure, and in particular with receivers lined up on the wrong side, which was the case here. You had a full house backfield, so that's something where Flacco never has that. Flacco never, I mean, his entire career he's probably had less than 10 snaps of full house backfield. So I assume that all three of those players were in the proper position and knew where they were supposed to be. Well, then the two receivers, and one was Ricard, who was a tight end set up on the right side, and the other was Montgomery, who was a wide receiver set up on the right side. Both of those guys need to be on opposite sides of the line of scrimmage and covering the ineligible receivers, covering the tackles. And Montgomery knew that he had to be off the line of scrimmage because he was a yard back. He looked at Ricard. He saw he was on the line of scrimmage. But he's got to also be able to look to the other side and say, hey, wait a minute, there's nobody on that side. I should call timeout.
Gotcha.
So Montgomery, I should have called it. But then the blame goes deeper than that because the Ravens have probably 10 headset elves that are out there in terms of quality control positions and game management positions and the offensive coordinator and all the offensive assistants and whatnot that are on the headset that have a chance to say, illegal formation, abort, abort,
right.
abort.
Right, they're watching from above.
And then Harbaugh can call that timeout from the sideline. He's the only one who could do that.
Yeah.
So anyway, any of the players could have noticed it, but that's a case where Jackson was probably the Ravens' best shot to get it stopped on field before it occurred. Montgomery might have been the second best chance. So I think if you're really looking for who was responsible for that illegal formation, which was a potentially very costly play in the game, didn't end up hurting the Ravens, but it was a costly play. I think that play was probably Montgomery not being in the right spot, if I had to guess.
Okay, and I think that was the one on that the announcers were saying maybe someone didn't register properly with the judge or whatever?
No, it wasn't
all lineup.
No, they had five eligible receivers on the field. So if you have a sixth lineman on the field, that's when you need to or you're changing up something about who's blocking. That's when you need to do that. But having Stanley report eligible wouldn't have changed the situation.
Or Ricard.
They would have had to still – Montgomery would have then had to have been on the line of scrimmage
for that
to be good if you'd done it. So anyway, there was at least one problem. The ways that had one problem, there were two receivers had to be on the opposite side. So my guess is Montgomery is probably the guy who messed it up.
Gotcha. Makes sense. He's new to the team and all.
Sure.
All right, let's get – speaking of Montgomery, let's get to the running back situation because the big breakout star of this game, besides Lamar, who was – he wasn't really a breakout because everyone was watching for the game. There was excitement in the stadium because of Lamar starting. But the surprise to everyone was Gus Edwards.
Yeah, so we talked about him a little bit on the defensive show, so I won't completely revisit this, but outstanding compliment to Jackson, straight ahead, power runner, limited cutting ability. He did a little bit of side-to-side cutting. Reminds me very much of LaRon McClain in terms of his running style with that low center of gravity, lots of yards after contact, and kind of a ponderous cutting style. I thought it was just hilarious when he ran for the touchdown, ran for the two-point conversion, then he was on the kick team to cover.
Right.
That's a point where Rosberg probably could pick one other player and say, hey, take a play off here. Edwards and get somebody else, but he didn't. He had him cover the kick. It was pretty cool.
And I'm sure if you're Gus Edwards, you don't want to be pulled. You're having the game of your life. Get me out there for every play.
Absolutely.
But even Collins looked good out there on Sunday.
Oh, so Collins is probably going to lose snaps the rest of the year, and the reason is his style is very similar to Lamar in terms of he is happy getting to the edge. And it really showed up on that TD, which was a speed touchdown to get to the pylon. I mean, he looked like Collins 2017 in terms of bounce, bounce, bounce to the outside, and then let's see if you can catch me. Not really liking inside lanes. I didn't think there were any inside opportunities to take that for a touchdown in that case. But really used his speed effectively on that touchdown. That was a great thing. It's just unfortunate that because Lamar's style is also to go to the outside, I think that he's better complemented by an inside power guy. I think also we're going to see the Ravens use more three receiver sets to try and take advantage of opposing nickels the rest of the way, which means that I think the Edwards and Jackson are the ideal backfield duo and potentially without a tight end. With only one tight end for much of the remainder of the year.
Right, and that one tight end is – we'll have to get to that one tight end next week because it was interesting to see Boyle after we talked about on the midseason that we didn't see much of Boyle. All of a sudden, he seemed to be Lamar's favorite tight end.
Yeah, so yeah, he was out there for some plays, certainly provided some value as a blocker, but he also allowed half a sack in the game, which wasn't good.
Right.
So there were a lot of things I liked a bit in the run game about how Boyle played. I don't want to say anything really bad about him, but it was a mixed bag for Boyle in this game.
Gotcha. Sticking with the running backs, what does this mean for Buck Allen?
Yeah, Buck Allen, I don't know even where he is on the depth chart because the Ravens are going to have to start making some roster decisions. He played just five snaps, had one carry for 2 yards, and unfortunately, you know, they have Dixon designated to return. He's going to come back, and I cannot believe the team is going to carry five running backs.
Right.
So I have to believe they're either going to defer the decision on Dixon at this point. It really seemed like Edwards was the obvious guy that was going to be cut, and ain't no way that's happening now.
Right. And Edwards and Allen seem to run the same style.
Allen is more of a straight-ahead runner, but he's in between as a slasher. And the same is true of Dixon as being between a slasher and a pure seek-the-edge guy like Collins is. But both of them are guys who can, you know, they can run off tackle. They can do the normal runs we're used to where you bounce it once to the outside or you make one cut run and cut once with zone blocking, for example. I think... You know, Allen has just never really shown anything as a runner in his NFL career. He's been a low yards per touch guy. You know, as a receiver, that's where he had most of his value this year so far. But his yards per reception are also very low. So I really question whether or not he's the ideal guy. Joe needs a check down guy. You want to have a back who can receive. And Dixon may be the guy, honestly, that the Ravens turn to going forward. Allen is in his fourth year, so the Ravens don't have any future option value in him. He's an unrestricted free agent at the end of the year. So unfortunately, I think there's probably a chance Allen gets cut during the last few weeks of the season at some point, because I don't see the Ravens carrying five running backs.
Right, and Montgomery also is supposed to have really good receiving skills.
Yes,
that's be that check down guy as well.
Yeah, outstanding point, and he's one that obviously that I didn't include in that discussion, but he could well be the guy. You know, there are people who are saying Montgomery could be released as well. I think that would be a foolish thing given. I mean, the seventh round draft pick is a sunk cost. I'm assuming it's not conditional. So with Montgomery, unless they have a way to get the seventh round pick back due to the conditions of the trade, I would say no, don't. You know, you want to take a chance on Montgomery, who I think has more upside as a receiver than Allen.
Right, so that puts him above Allen. What's this mean for Ricard and his offensive use?
Well, I think we're going to see reduced fullback use, which means Ricard may be deactivated for some games, but they still need him as a defensive lineman. So the fifth defensive lineman, which I'm never an advocate of going into an NFL game with only four, although the Ravens have done it in recent years. But with the fifth defensive lineman, is always going to be him or Sealer. And I would think most games it's going to be Ricard because of what else he provides. On special teams, he still covers kicks, which is to me amazing. He you know, is on the field goal unit, obviously. He does the defensive line as a emergency player only, did not play in this game. But I think you're going to see a reduced fullback role for Ricard. And he was a very effective fullback, but just with Jackson in there, it doesn't make as much sense to have a fullback in there. Effectively, Jackson acts as an extra man you have to account for. So in some sense, he's providing a phantom block for you by sprinting out to one side or whatever and taking a defender out of the play. So I don't see as much use for Ricard in the offense going forward. And what we'll see of him, probably be a tight end, would be my guess.
All right. And yeah, and Jackson's also not the type of guy who's going to follow a fullback. He kind of just makes his own decisions and goes on his own.
Yeah, Jackson wouldn't be. So the question is, do you want some of Edwards' straight-ahead running to be behind a fullback, or do you benefit from more of Edwards' straight-ahead running being against the nickel, where the other team will only have two offensive linemen and have a more spread defense with one extra cornerback on the field? And I think the Ravens will find they prefer that more, is that they'd rather run against the nickel than have a fullback going forward.
Gotcha. All right, let's talk about this offensive line like we do each week. And I was somewhat surprised to see Stanley out on the field with his injury concerns.
Yeah, I mean, Stanley's return, just I can't say enough about it. I mean, just he kept getting hurt. It looked like he took a helmet to the ankle early in the game that caused him to miss some plays. He left on three separate occasions in very obvious pain. Heroic effort. He was outstanding in the game from a play standpoint. He made 60 out of 64 blocks. He only allowed 1.5 pressures in the game. And he faces Michael Johnson, who's not a top-tier pass rusher by any stretch, but somebody who's given the Ravens problems in the past. And also Lawson on some plays, who is a very good pass rusher. And he did a great job in this game. He just did a fantastic job. And I now look at what he's done. Is he got an A in this game. And his last grade since the Bengals game, where he got a D in the first matchup, since week three, he's had A-, B-, A, C, B, A, A. And that's exactly the kind of trend line that I associate with his rookie year, when he was improving for all those consecutive weeks in the second half of the season and was an elite left tackle at the end. Injuries have slowed him down these last 2 years, but his level of play I'm just really excited about. It's one of the things to be very positive about down the stretch for the Ravens.
All right. How about Matt Skura?
Well, can we start at stick at left guard with Lewis first, if you don't mind?
Yeah, of course.
So he rebounded from a tough performance. He got an F in the previous game to have an A in this game. To have a B in this game, his best performance of the year. So he faces some of those inside guys. And Atkins, of course, was himself and very good in this game. But the other guy who really had a big game was Billings. Billings gave Yanda a lot of trouble in this game in particular. Lewis did much better in terms of than Yanda, in fact, in terms of maintaining his blocks in the pass game in particular. He only allowed 1.5 pressures in the game, one shared and one full. He missed four blocks. I had to look at every single one of his blocks again to make sure that I hadn't overscored somehow or made it better than it was. But I did, and I'm sorry about that. He had actually 6 missed blocks in the game, not 4. But still, outstanding game for him. 0.84 per play when I adjust for quality of competition. He didn't have any highlight blocks, but quality of competition, he gets a B. Just was really good at making his individual blocks and maintaining them. And one thing that he and Skura did together is they had a lot of double teams, particularly on Edwards' runs, where, and also on some of Jackson's runs, where they got double team movement on either Billings or Adkins, and it was very impressive and very good. And neither of those guys is an earth mover individually, but to see them be able to move people with a double team is very useful when you have the need to open a hole to level 2 for Edwards and the desire to get Edwards matched up against a kind of a mediocre set of linebackers from a tackling perspective. So that was very useful to the Ravens. Big game from Lewis, and I liked it a lot.
All right, that's great. Now we can get to Matt Skura, the center.
Sure. Matt Skura, also another good game, had his second A of the season. He had an A against Denver in week three. He did allow a pressure to Billings where he got pancaked, actually, on the play. He missed 3 blocks. One was relatively innocuous, missed pull. That's kind of a low-cost miss, though they all count as 0 score. And he was overwhelmed twice physically when the ball was either out quickly or was a run play that went for a gain anyway. So, again, none of those 3 really end up costing the Ravens. 2 of those 3 are bad indicators. But his overall play was excellent, 0.92 in terms of a raw score, an A after adjustment, and, again, his best game of the year.
All right. Marshall Yanda came out with the media this morning to say that he would never spit on another player, never has, never will. Clearly, that's been all the news about Marshall Yanda the past couple of days and the video of him and Perfect. How did Yanda actually play, though, in the game?
Yeah, Yanda had his worst game of the year. And so he had a bunch of different problems. Now, part of it is Yanda's most difficult opponent and the player he's had the most trouble with by far over the years is Geno Atkins. Okay, it's just he plays him twice per year. Geno's one hell of a player, and it's the one guy in the whole league that Yanda has had by far the most trouble with. This was a game where it wasn't that much different. Although Yanda also had some trouble with Billings, number 99, if you look at the film, who had a fine game himself, and he did some things well, but he did some other things that were not that great. He allowed the penetration by Billings to take down. I'm sorry, penetration by Atkins. To take down Jackson for the loss of 2 when the Ravens had a chance to really improve their situation to 28-21 instead of the 24-21 they settled for after Tucker's field goal. So they had that was a play down on about the 4 or 5 yard line on third down. So it looked like Jackson had a clear path to the end zone, but Atkins tripped him up because Yanda was beaten on the play. He had a hand in each of the 2 sacks, and admittedly, Yanda played pretty well. In general, I didn't think he deserved any more than half charge for either of those sacks, but he had a half and a third as I saw it on the 2 plays. Not his best game. He wasn't penalized. He almost never is, but he did miss 7 blocks in total on the game. 0.71 per play after adjustment at guard. He fits in at the bottom of the C range. So, a Hall of Fame player having an off game against a top opponent, not huge news, and it's great that the rest of the line played well and really picked him up in this one.
All right, let's get to Orlando Brown. We've talked before about how he's a downfield lineman, and he seems like the right guy in front of Jackson.
So, yeah, so some things about Orlando that were kind of funny in this game. First of all, he had 9 blocks in level 2, so that speaks to your point there, is that he's really been more mobile than I think any scouts ever gave him credit for in terms of his ability to connect in level 2. And he's looking now like he's less lost in space. So when he goes to level 2, it's not like he can't figure out who he's supposed to block, as it did look in the first week. So, actually not week 1 against Buffalo. I merely mean his first start. So anyway, he made 9 of 14 blocks in level 2, and that's a high total for a tackle. Tackles often get caught in level 2 on the backside of a run play and unable to find a good block to make. Orlando making 9 out of 14, I'm very happy with. He delivered 2 pancakes. He had 2 nice highlight combination blocks. Very little bad to say about it other than he was party to both sacks. Those were his only pressure events. The first, he let Dunlap make the initial flush on Jackson for half a sack, and then he got a sixth of a sack when he had an odd release downfield on the second sack. And that play, I think he would have been flagged for illegal man downfield or ineligible receiver downfield, I should say, if Jackson had got off the pass. But it looked like he was anticipating a quarterback run or a screen pass on the play, because he's 5 yards downfield between the hashes as Jackson is being sacked on the play. And there's a picture out of it on RSR that I put in, but it's actually a funny position for him to be in. It looks like he was expecting either a screen or a quarterback run. A for Brown, his best game as a pro to date.
That's great. That's exciting to see rookies play well and start to shine. We did see Illuminor and Bozeman a little bit on Sunday.
I want to talk briefly about Bozeman. He entered for three plays, and normally, you just hope to make your blocks. Bozeman made the most of this opportunity. Three blocks. The third block he made that was scored was on the touchdown run by Edwards at Q3 107. He made a fine block on that way to keep Dunlap engaged. It kept Dunlap from making a tackle, and he was in the best position to do so. Fine block by Bozeman. He followed it up with an unscored highlight seal on that 2-point conversion, and he actually is blocking two players from getting in the play, both Billings and Nickerson. He's holding off on the left edge as Edwards runs right by him through the clear for the easy 2-point conversion. So it looked easy because Bradley made it easy on that play. Unscored play, but if this were a game where he had other snaps, I'd give him a big positive subjective adjustment for that block in particular. And Illuminor came in 8 snaps, made 7 blocks. He came in 3 separate occasions, and he held the fort while Stanley was out. So, solid play again from Illuminor, and Ravens offensive line top to bottom. It's hard to really find any warts on this game. So, fine game. Yonda's performance would be the only thing I'd point to as it didn't really work out.
All right, that's good. Always good to have a solid line. Let's get to the MVPs for Sunday.
Okay, so I'll go 3-1. I don't know if you want to participate too, but I'll start.
I've got some guys here.
Oh, okay.
I'm all set.
Okay, so number 3, I have Ronnie Stanley. I thought of the individual linemen, his play and the adverse circumstances with the injury and whatnot really earned him the number 3 star.
All right, I've got Justin Tucker. I think he could be the MVP every week, but it's so nice when watching the Ravens football that we don't have to have the concerns the rest of the NFL has.
Now, Justin Tucker, now, if you want to express, I don't know if we did this on the last show, but we're going to do it again anyway. He's made 21 consecutive field goals from 50 through 57 yards, the longest streak in NFL history. Matt Bryant, who the Ravens will face in 2 weeks, has an active 17-kick streak as well, including the playoffs. So that'll have an interesting subcontext with it. Now, the other stat is that Tucker has made 98 consecutive field goals when you exclude blocks and only consider kicks of 57 or fewer yards. So among blocked attempts from 57 or fewer yards, Justin Tucker has made 98 straight field goals.
Yeah, that's,
that is just amazing.
That's awesome. Especially, it was highlighted this week when the Bengals went for a field goal to tie it and fell way short.
Yeah, that's right. So it was 52 yards wide right. I mean, that is chip shot Tucker range. And they didn't make it happen. So it was a big difference in that game.
All right.
So my number 2 guy is Edwards. He's number 2 for me.
Can't argue with that.
You're going with him too?
No, I'm going to throw Chris Moore in as the number 2. Because for one catch, that one ball that was thrown behind him that he pulled in. So I'm going to give him a little credit right there.
Okay, fair enough to get some love for Chris Moore. He certainly has earned more snaps. The Ravens can't seem to get snaps for Chris Moore, which means they can't seem to figure out how to get off the free agent wide receiver treadmill. They're never going to get snaps for Jordan Lasley if they can't get for Chris Moore. So I agree that Moore deserves some recognition in a season he's having where he's caught the ball very effectively.
Right.
My number 1 is Jackson. I think it'd be hard to go with anybody else. He had tremendous poise in getting the Ravens through this game. He did what was necessary to win. He will never, ever rush the ball 27 times again, but in doing so, he won this game for the Ravens and meshed extremely well with Edwards' style as well.
Right. Clearly, your top 3 are the real stars of the game. I just can't pick the same guys as you, so I'm giving it to Marvin Lewis because I don't understand why he's still a head coach, and I love that he was calling the defense against us on Sunday because there was no adjustment.
That's a great thing, and I love your style of doing it anyway. Wouldn't do the show a lot of good if we just had the same number 1, the same number 2, and different on number 3. So.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, we haven't had any cats on the field yet or anything this year, so I've got to actually pick guys who touch the grass a little bit.
There you go.
So, all right, Ken, let's get to a little bit of mailbag before we get out for our Thanksgiving break. And let's see. Let's go with, other than the poor rushing yards per attempt, how does the offensive line compare to last year's 2017? And how does Skura at center compare to Jensen?
Okay, well, if you look at PFF, Skura and Jensen are very similarly rated this season. So, I have some differences in view of how PFF handles their scoring, but one of the things is they tend to rate down a player like Skura, who makes and holds a lot of run blocks without winning them by moving the opposing player. So they would tend to really rate down Skura. But Skura's in the middle of the pack of centers, and so is Jensen. And so obviously Skura being tremendously cheaper would seem to be the better deal. Now, I honestly believe that Jensen has more value as a player than probably what he's shown, and certainly more upside than what Skura has as a player. So I'm not completely convinced on that, but I also haven't watched Jensen's games this year to see what's actually gone wrong with his blocking. But yeah, the offensive line in general, to answer your other question, there's a lot to be excited about on this offensive line. It's a fairly young line with some players coming out of this game that look a lot better than they did before. And we mentioned on the offensive evaluations, they really had to sift through five guys who are kind of backup talent to decide which ones they want to keep going forward and then maybe also draft an offensive lineman. And those five guys include Lewis, Bozeman, Illuminor, Skura, and Siragusa. And now, you know, with good games from several of them this week, you know, it's going to make that decision-making process all the harder, and that's a great problem to have.
Right.
There will be offensive line injuries next year. Next year, I'd expect the Ravens will carry nine on the offensive line, given the depth they have and given the likelihood that they have a draft pick as well.
All right. Should the Ravens consider using more two tight end slots, since we've got a bunch of tight ends that have shown a little bit of promise?
Okay, great point. Great question. Love that. Probably the answer is they're going to skip between using some ones and some twos and some threes. But I think a lot of their running packages now with Jackson and with Edwards are going to try and take advantage of running against the nickel. So to run against the nickel, they need to put three wide receivers on the field. That puts an extra cornerback on the field. It puts one less defensive lineman on the field. And then you rely more on the elusiveness of Jackson and the straight ahead power of Edwards to get your run advantages. And I actually think it's better to use one tight end and one running back among your five eligible receivers in those situations, because I think you do better to spread the defense out for those two very complementary running styles.
All right. A quick defense question. How do we sometimes seem to have such a dominant pass rush and other times look completely inept?
Yeah, I mean, the four-week stretch of not getting home with the pass rush is really troublesome. Part of it is injuries. Obviously, missing Willie Henry and missing Tim Williams is a big deal. Willie Henry is probably the bigger loss because he's being replaced by another inside pass rusher that's just probably not as skilled and not as able to create some good opportunities via stunts and twists. So I like the fact that they're still among the leaders in sacks despite what's gone on. I don't like the fact that they've now got three sacks in 4 weeks and what that really means about where they are. I think the secondary is really doing their part to hold up. A little part of it is schematic that Martindale has throttled back on the pass rush deception and throttled back on the numbers in the pass rush these last 4 weeks because of the better quarterbacks they've been facing. So, you know, some of it is that, but I would be the first to agree with you that the pass rush has been, MIA the last 4 weeks in terms of winning as many one-on-one matchups as they did earlier in the year.
Gotcha. All right, and a quick reminder that you can get in your questions using the hashtag FilmStudyMailbag on Twitter. Final question for you this week. After Lamar's first game, what do we look for in the next game against the Raiders to see Lamar progressing and growing and how the team's using him? What should we watch for?
Right. Well, I think the first thing, first and foremost, they're going to have to find how to run the running game with less Lamar. So I think they should try and get down to, you know, a dozen carries for Lamar might be a reasonable goal in his second game. Use Edwards more, use Collins maybe more for the outside instead of Lamar. But, you know, the other thing I want to see whether or not it it the situation develops with, is another question, is for him to just do more passing from the pocket. So make use of the pocket, show better awareness of how the pocket is holding up, and don't compromise the pocket personally. Use the pocket that exists there as well as he can. Joe Flacco is very good at that. He stays in the pocket for as long as possible, oftentimes until he gets sacked. Lamar will probably avoid some sacks by staying in the pocket longer. He'll also make some plays when he tries to evade the pocket and get outside, as we saw in this game. The on the under pressure numbers, the without ATS numbers, were terrific for Lamar. I'd love to see that continue. I don't expect it will. So I just say more of a regression towards a normal NFL quarterback style with fewer runs and more passes from the pocket is what I'd like to see from Lamar.
All right. So if you're the Ravens this week, what you're looking for is you're practicing getting him comfortable in that pocket and forcing him to stay in that pocket for practice.
Yeah, there you go. That question from Joe in Rockville. Thanks, Joe.
All right. All right, Ken, let's let people know what's up on Russell Street, because you've been busy this week. You got the offensive breakdown that we just kind of went through. You've got the defensive breakdown that you always do, and you also have this tiebreaker article up there.
So, yeah, three articles out there. If you want a little more detail on what's going on, you can look there and follow some individual plays and get the quarter and time references for things, see if I'm full of crap on what I'm saying about the about individual plays, see if you agree. Follow me on Twitter at Film Study Ravens. I'm very active there during the day. Love to hear from you. Love to get good discussions started about football. Toss in your questions. I try and respond to every single one, although I don't always do it immediately. I will try and get to every single question posed. If you have a comment and you want to make it with an at Film Study Ravens, that's cool too. You get the rest of the Baltimore analyst community largely involved in that discussion very quickly. So happy to have it. And tell us about Birdland Sports.
Yeah, everything is fixed with Hostin, I think. That's the big news for Birdland Sports and Film Study and Section 336. Go over to Section 336 and listen to that. Listen to us get excited for Mike Elias now that he is the Orioles GM. And I'm sure they just announced today that Sig, I'm just going to go with, because I don't know how to pronounce the last name yet, and I know I'll get it wrong, who is the analytics head from the Astros, who recently left the Astros, is now joining Elias in Baltimore. So that's as the assistant GM. So that's big news. So I'm sure we'll either have a quick mini episode of 336 soon to discuss that, or we'll at least be discussing it on Monday.
All right. I'm really excited to see how that plays out, because the organization in the 1970s when I grew up was so clued in to the early levels of sabermetrics, even though they didn't call them those at the time, where they really understood the value of the walk in particular, and built the franchise around it. I'm really excited to see Elias and his number two rebuild the Orioles' dedication to the walk.
It's really exciting because it's not a copycat move. We're bringing guys who are creating new things. I think when you think of the Houston Astros, you think of pitchers who go there, and you would hear about the spin rate, and suddenly they're a better pitcher because of the spin rate. No one else was doing that before Houston.
Huh.
And that's these guys, and they're now in Baltimore not to copycat what the Astros are doing, but to continue to advance analytics in baseball, and specifically in Baltimore. But it's also very important to remind people it's a long-term move. It doesn't mean we're winning the World Series next year. Let's look at 5-6 years and see what goes down.
Well, it's a great move to get a 35-year-old GM if you really believe in him, because you could have him for 25 years.
Yes.
I mean, he can be the fixture in Baltimore baseball for a quarter century if things really worked out.
Right. They're being very clear about not saying how long his contract is. And the truth is, you're right, it could go on forever. So, all right, Ken. Well, have a great Thanksgiving. Enjoy the Raiders game on Sunday.
All right. Take it easy, Josh.
at Lowe's, we're your go-to for great gardening values every day. That's why we've lowered our price on select bagged mulch, now starting at just $2.88 a bag. Mulch helps prevent weeds and retains moisture, and when you put it down around trees, shrubs, and flower beds, you'll see how beautiful it makes your outdoor space. Just in time to welcome back family and friends. Shop online and pick up in-store. Lowe's, home to the best part of summer. Selection and product availability vary by location. While supplies last, U.S. only, excludes Alaska and Hawaii.